Well, it's great to see everybody here this morning. Really appreciate your presence. We do have some visitors with us, and this is really an honor to have you here today. If this is your first time meeting with us, or if you're new to the area, just let East Shelby know if there's anything we can do to help you. I know that we've got a few people that have moved to the area recently, and we just want to make sure that you know that we're here and available if you need to get to know the area, if you'd like to know where the best restaurants are. You can't eat at a lot of them most of the time, but, you know, someday you'll be able to eat at some of our good restaurants in Memphis. But we just want you to know it is a real honor and a privilege to have any visitors with us today. If you're tuning into our live stream and you're not familiar with our congregation, then we are also very honored by your attention to spiritual things today. And if you want to know more information about our congregation, you can find it at eastshelby.com. You can also go to youtube.com/eastshelby and see other sermons and online video Bible studies and other material that we have available. We just want to make sure that whether you're here in this community or you're somewhere out in the world watching online, that you know that you have a friend in East Shelby and that we want to answer any biblical questions that you have and help you draw closer to Jesus Christ through a greater knowledge and obedience to His Word. A few moments ago, we read from Matthew chapter 17. That is going to be our main text for the day. And Matthew chapter 17, verses 24 through the end of the chapter. Kind of an interesting incident in the ministry of Jesus. I think it's one of those stories that we sometimes forget about. Like, what was that story about when Jesus found a couple coins in the mouth of a fish? And that's probably the most memorable thing that we can recall about this interesting anecdote from his ministry. But believe it or not, there are actually some really interesting applications to Matthew chapter 17. Some interesting applications to what we're facing today in 2020 as well. Yeah, we're going to talk about a lot of things today, and you're wondering, how is Matthew chapter 17 possibly applicable to what we're facing today? We're going to talk about coronavirus, and we're going to talk about the pandemic. We're going to talk about wearing masks, and we're going to talk about protests and social justice. And yes, I think Matthew chapter 17 very much is applicable to some of the things that we're facing today in our own culture. So let's read it again, just for emphasis' sake. I want everyone to be really familiar with this story before we make some application from the text. In Matthew chapter 17 and verse 24, it says, "When they had come to Capernaum, those who collected the 2 drachma tax came to Peter, and they said, 'Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? And he said, 'Yes.' Now when he came to the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, 'What do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs or poll taxes? From their sons or from strangers?' Now, upon his saying, 'From strangers,' Jesus said to him, 'Consequently, the sons are exempt. But lest we give them any offense, go to the sea, throw in a hook, and take the first fish that comes up. When you open its mouth, you'll find a stater. Take that and give it to them for you and for me.'" Why does this story take place in Capernaum? And what's going on with this poll tax, right? I mean, that's, I think, the main question that we would have as we enter into this text is, what exactly is going on? Now, for most of Jesus' life up to this point, he'd been a resident of Nazareth. But at some point, he moved to Capernaum, probably around the age of 30. So at that point in his life, he would have been under the jurisdiction of tax collectors in that community. So it makes sense then, when he comes back to Capernaum, that that is the place where he's going to be hounded by tax collectors, or at least where this subject is going to be brought up. The tax was typically collected in March, but payments were sometimes irregular, and you might have had to pay at any given point in the year. To accommodate those who were unable to pay, there were actually 2 boxes that were left out. One box was available for the current year's tax, and another box was available for anybody who had missed the previous year's tax. My point being, there's always been the IRS, so stop complaining about it. One writer put it really well. McGarvey said in the Fourfold Gospel, kind of describing this incident, he said, "The law of Moses required from every male of 20 years and up the payment of a tax of 0.5 shekel for the support of the tabernacle," which of course was then the temple. Let me give you a couple of passages you can put in your notes just to study later on. Exodus chapter 30, verses 12 through 16, And 2 Chronicles 24, verses 5 through 6 are some pertinent Old Testament passages along those lines. The tax was collected annually. But here's the thing. If you're a law-abiding Jew in the first century, and you've got this obligation to pay a tax for the support of the temple in Jerusalem, but you also have taxes that you're supposed to be paying to the Roman Empire, you probably end up feeling that that's kind of unfair. Many of the Jews in the first century believed that they were being double taxed, essentially, because they had an obligation both to their own people and the temple and to the Roman Empire, and they felt like that was a little bit unfair. So this became like a real sticking point, right? One of those very over-the-top, dramatic kind of arguments that people tended to have. Does that sound a little bit familiar to you in 2020? Some Jews believed that it was unpatriotic to pay the Roman tax, and so they refused. They fought it tooth and nail. They said, I'm already paying taxes for the support of the Jewish people in our temple. I don't think it's fair to have to pay taxes to the Romans. The Romans, they're this empire. They're dominating our lives, and we want nothing more than for the Messiah to come and finally cast off the shackles of the Roman Empire. I don't think it's patriotic to have to pay the Romans a tax. Of course, there were other Jews who were collaborators with the Romans. The Sadducees, for example. The chief priests who happened to be running the temple. Usually the chief priests came from a class of people that were handpicked by the Roman governor to rule there in Jerusalem. They were basically collaborators with the Romans. So you, of course, had other Jews who were friends with the Romans and said, well, you know, we just got to get along and do what needs to be done, don't we? Just pay the tax. What's the big deal? So I find it really interesting here as a first main point to my lesson that Jesus was willing to talk about the toughies of his day. You know, I think you know what I mean by toughies, right? You know when you hear a question from somebody, you go, ooh, boy, that's a toughie. When hypothetical situations or kind of gotcha questions, that sort of thing, Jesus was willing to engage with the people of his time on the questions that they felt like were pertinent. I think that's a very important point to bring out. There were other situations where people asked him questions about the Sabbath day. There were other times where people asked Jesus questions about, well, my brother won't divide the inheritance with me, and he's being kind of a snob about that. And there were other times that people asked Jesus about the temple, what activities could go along there. There were other times that people directly confronted Jesus about paying taxes to Caesar. And is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar? You know, these are not questions that were necessarily religious questions, but they were the pertinent questions of the day. And you never see Jesus just kind of brush people aside and say, well, that's not what I'm here to talk about. You know, if someone has a question, and they really do listen to Jesus when he says that I am the bearer of all truth, I am the way, the truth, and life. If you're going to take that seriously, then you understand that Jesus is going to have relevant things to say on just about any question that you have for him. For today, the church needs to make sure that it is not quiet when it comes to the important questions of our time. That we need to have biblical answers to the things that come up in our conversations, whether it's things that we see in the news, whether it's things that are happening in our own communities, whether it's things that are happening in our church that are threatening to divide us. Christians need to be willing to engage with our neighbors and our enemies and our brothers and sisters in Christ when it comes to pertinent questions of the day, even the toughies. And so I like in this story that here's a question about, well, what are we supposed to do? Pay the tax to the Romans or pay the tax to the temple, pay the tax to nobody, pay both taxes. And Jesus, at the end of the story, is willing to engage and talk about those pertinent questions of the day. And again, this is not the only time that Jesus was willing to field questions on difficult subjects, even things relating to taxes and the Romans. Things that you might be able to just kind of brush aside and say, well, that's just purely secular. This last week, my sister and I, my sister-in-law, and I don't have a sister, I have plenty of sisters-in-law, but my sister-in-law and I were talking actually about a preacher who once said, I just don't think that Christians need to worry about anything that is not explicitly addressed in the Bible. I don't think you should preach about anything. If it's not explicitly addressed in the Bible, then I don't think Christians need to worry about it. I don't think Christians need to talk about it. I think it's a real big mistake, though. When the people who have the closest access to our Creator, the people who are supposed to be purveyors of truth, the people who are supposed to know what it is that God thinks about things, because we have an understanding of His Word. I just think that when Christians just kind of like brush aside questions of the day, the pertinent topics of the day, and we just sort of like brush them aside as unimportant matters, it just makes us look aloof and disconnected. It makes us seem like if we can't answer difficult questions about things that are going on in the news, then why should people trust us when it comes to spiritual matters as well? Christians should very much engage with their neighbors and their enemies as well when it comes to the toughies of the day. So the question is asked here in verse 24, and notice how it's phrased, by the way, because this is an important point to bring out. Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? Other translations might put it a different way, like, doesn't Jesus pay the tax? Look at the way they phrase the question. Kind of a sneaky way to phrase it, isn't it? To phrase it in the negative. Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? There's a word for this, and it's called insinuation. Insinuation is when you use your language to subtly accuse somebody of something wicked or wrong, right? Now, you don't come right out and say it. You say something in a way that there's kind of an undercurrent of, really? I didn't realize you were such a racist. Insinuation is when you use your language to try and make the person you're talking to or to talk about look as bad as possible without just coming right out and saying it. Does he not? To phrase it in the negative means they're insinuating that Jesus wouldn't pay the tax. And how shocking that your teacher would not pay the 2 drachma tax. How scandalous that is that your teacher wouldn't pay the 2 drachma. Would he not pay it? They assume that to be the case. I need to be really careful when it comes to insinuation. Now, I don't want to put too much stock into this phrase because I understand it is what it is. They're simply phrasing their question the way that it is. But we need to be very careful to watch out for questions like this when we engage with people and talk to people, right? When we talk about those toughies, those difficult and pertinent questions of the day, be really careful that you're being constructive and productive and positive in the way that you talk about those things. We are often posed with situations where either an unbeliever or a friend of ours or a family member of ours comes to us with some misconception of some kind about Christianity. And again, we need to be really, really careful that when we talk about those things, that we're not trying to insinuate. Now, I'm going to go ahead and give you a few examples of insinuation that I have noticed recently. And I'm going to warn you in advance, whether you're conservative or liberal or you're a Republican or a Democrat, I'm not accusing any one of you specifically of saying these things, but I'm going to step on some toes. Which is always good as a preacher. You want to make sure as a preacher that you alienate yourself from everybody in the room. No, I'm just warning you in advance. And again, I'm not saying any of these things to say that you specifically or any one of you has said these things. And I'm also not saying these things to say that I am pro this or anti that, that I am for this or against that. I'm not going to reveal what I really think about any of these statements. I just want you to see that when you use insinuation in your conversations, how unproductive it actually is. It shuts people down. It puts people on the defensive when you make statements like this. When the issue of race comes up, and social justice, and protests, when you phrase a question like this, what? You don't care about your African American neighbors and what they're going through? You don't care about the black community in your city? That's an insinuation, and it's not a productive way to speak. But let's flip it on the other side, shall we? When the issue of tearing statues comes up, right? When you're tearing down statues of Confederate soldiers, we insinuate with the following statement: I didn't realize that you just wanted to completely rewrite American history. Well, I don't think that's what people really want, is it? Rewriting history? How about the subject of abortion? When we're talking about abortion, so what, are you just suggesting that abortion isn't a big deal and that it's just okay to kill any baby that you want at any point? Well, it's probably not what that person is arguing. But I also hear this when people find out that I am vehemently pro-life. I often hear this argument from them. And again, I'm not trying to tell you I'm pro this or anti that. I am pro-life. Vehemently pro-life. But when people find out that I'm pro-life, I'm often confronted with the following question: that, really, if you're as pro-life as you say you are, then why don't you care about the lives of children caught up in the foster system? If you're really as pro-life as you say you are, then why don't you care about the lives of undocumented immigrants? What's being insinuated there? And of course, there's masks as well. There's the face masks. What, you don't care about other people's health? What, you don't believe in science? You see what I mean? When you phrase a question in the negative like that and you insinuate something, you insinuate that the person you're talking to holds a position that is the most extreme, the most despicable, the most heinous possible position on a subject, that just puts people on the defensive. And it doesn't lead to productive, useful, constructive conversations. And here's the thing. It's very easy in a debate or an argument or a conversation to rely too heavily on insinuation because it gives you this thin veneer of having the moral high ground. Because if I can just make you look like Adolf Hitler, well, then I don't really have to confront the weaknesses of my own argument. Because really, I didn't realize, Walt, I didn't realize that you were so close to Adolf Hitler. And what that does is, when I can make you look like a complete monster, then I don't really have to confront the weaknesses in my own argument. I don't really have to think about where the weakness might be in what I'm saying. Insinuation, then, is a lazy and nefarious way to confront people. It is a lazy and nefarious way to have conversations. It is a lazy and nefarious way to debate something. And when these people come up to Peter, and by the way, they go to Peter, not Jesus. They kind of do the back door approach, don't they? Does your teacher not pay the 2 drachma tax? This is not a very constructive way to have a conversation with people. So watch out for insinuation when you talk to others. And by the way, Peter's response, I think, is an indication, if subtle, but it's an indication that he understood exactly what they were saying. They were insinuating something that was shocking and scandalous, and very quickly, and almost with embarrassment, Peter says, yeah, he does. Don't worry. Let's all calm down here. Of course Jesus pays the 2 drachma tax. Yes, of course he does. You know why? Because Peter would be embarrassed if he didn't. Peter does not want to be viewed as part of some rabble-rousing crowd. Peter does not want to rock the boat. And when this negative question is given to him, he's, again, in embarrassment, almost shocked, like, yes, of course he pays the tax. Who wouldn't pay the tax, right? We're all law-abiding taxpayers over here in the group of Jesus' disciples. He's embarrassed by it. He's defensive. And he answers so emphatically that I think he betrays that embarrassment. Now, when he came to the house, Jesus spoke to him first, saying, "What do you think, Simon?" I love the way that he goes to Peter and is willing to just talk to him. That there's no judgment. He doesn't step on him. He doesn't shoot him down. He says, "Oh, Peter, let's talk about this." Because the ever-present, all-knowing Jesus doesn't ever allow anything to slip by his attention. What do you think, Peter? From whom do the kings of the earth collect customs and poll taxes? Do they collect taxes from their own sons or from strangers in the land? Simple enough question, I suppose. If you were the king of a land and you had people coming and going, there were caravans coming through your land from one point to another, you had control and you maintained roads going through your land, you had ports and there were people traveling from one distant land to another distant land and used you as a port, of course, it is reasonable to collect taxes from those passing through your land. But does a king look at his own son, a prince in his own household, and say, "Son, time to pay up"? I mean, I know that we joke about, like, dads always joke about that sort of thing. I remember my dad one time, who is an accountant, by the way. I remember my dad one time, he gave me an estimate of how much I had cost him up to that point. It's not a good number. I looked it up recently, by the way, because I know that because of inflation and all that stuff, that the number is different. I looked it up, by the way. And on average, and I don't know if you're going to be shocked by this or not, on average, to raise a child from birth to adult independence, on average in the United States, it costs around $500,000 per child. Oh, $500,000? That means I have just guaranteed myself $1.5 million of child debt for, you know, like 25 years. It's expensive, but you know what? I know we joke. Dads joke about it. We joke about, I'll give you free room and board. The least you can do is mow the grass, right? We joke about stuff like that. But in reality, does any father ever, does a father collect taxes from his own kids? Of course he doesn't. He's not collecting taxes from his kids. And Peter knows that. And so Peter answers in the only logical way. He says, well, from strangers, of course. That's the only logical answer. So Jesus said, consequently, the sons are exempt. Now that's a simple, obvious answer, but there's a huge, big idea behind that answer. It's a huge idea. The sons are exempt. Jesus is making an acknowledgement here that he is the Son of God. That he is not required to pay the temple tax. Why? Because that temple was built for him. Because as co-creator of the entire universe, every single molecule in the entire universe is his. It's his. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. He spoke it all into existence. The timbers that hold it up, the stone facade that's on the outside, the gold that's on the furniture, every single molecule in the temple is already God's. And every coin, every single gold coin, who made that gold? God did. It is all his. And Jesus, as Son of God, as co-creator of the universe, as deity dwelling in bodily form, he doesn't have to pay taxes to a temple that was built for him. He's exempt. So yeah, simple answer. Of course, fathers don't collect taxes from their sons. We all know that. That's a simple idea. We get that. But there is a huge implication in what Jesus is saying. It is an acknowledgement that he is the Son of God. He is all powerful. He is in control. But lest we give them offense. It's another interesting statement that he makes here in verse 27. But lest we give them offense. This is a great example of when to compromise for others. Even though Jesus was not actually obligated to pay the tax, as the Son of God, Jesus was clearly exempt from that. But was it a sin to just pay it anyway? Who does it hurt to pay the tax? Jesus wasn't obligated to pay it, but who does it hurt to pay it? Hurt anybody. In fact, more good was done in the humble act of paying than if Jesus had imposed his right for exemption as the Son in this story. Essentially, Jesus is telling Peter that in this case, not paying the tax sends the wrong idea and would produce nothing but ill will, especially if the people that are asking this question are already set against him. If they're asking this question because they're kind of already looking for an excuse, right? These are people, they've phrased the question as a negative thing. They've insinuated something. They've kind of subtly accused Jesus of some kind of scandal. They're already set against Jesus. And I think Jesus in this case is saying, effectively, let's not take the bait. Let's not take the bait here. They are baiting me. Peter, they're baiting you. So let's not take the bait. Let's just pay the tax. That way when they go home to their Pharisee friends, right? When they go back home to their Pharisee friends, they go, ooh, that slippery Jesus got away again. We asked him a question about the temple tax and man, he just outsmarted us again. Because that's how Pharisees talked, apparently. But Jesus, again, effectively, he's saying, don't take the bait. Don't take the bait. Let's just pay the tax. Now, there's a few other passages in the New Testament, I think, illustrate this same point of, just don't give offense. It doesn't hurt you to do something. It doesn't hurt you to compromise. It doesn't, if it's not a sin, you know, just do what needs to be done. Get along with people. Let me give you a couple other passages here. We all know from 1 Corinthians chapter 8 as well as 1 Corinthians chapter 10. In chapters 8 and 10 of 1 Corinthians, Paul is addressing this subject of eating meat sacrificed to idols. Right? And Paul makes an acknowledgement in chapter 8 that we know that there's not really any other God but the one true God. We know that. We know that in all the pantheon of the Greeks and the pantheon of the Romans, and we know that in all of their great pantheons, all their mythology, those aren't real gods. They're not actually real. We know that. And so when they build a statue to Zeus, it's just a statue. There's no power that it has. It's not actually deity. It does not command the clouds and the thunder and the lightning. It does not command anyone's destiny. We get that. And so if you lay a piece of meat on the altar of Zeus and you cook that meat up and everyone's all excited and they're having some bacchanalian craziness around it, it's not really some sin to eat a piece of meat that's been sacrificed to Zeus. It's not. It's a piece of meat that was put on a fire in front of a statue. It doesn't actually have power. But are there some people that because of the way that they were raised in a Greek or Roman religious environment, are there some people that would be very offended in their sensibilities eating meat sacrificed to idols? Are there a lot of people who were raised Jewish who then, because they were raised in a Jewish environment, became Christians, and knowing what they know and their entire history of idolatry in the Old Testament, that they would be offended? Yes! And so if that is the case, he says in 1 Corinthians 8 verse 13, if food causes my brother to stumble, well, I'll never eat meat again, that I might not cause my brother to stumble. You know, does it hurt anybody just to not eat the meat sacrificed to idols? Does it hurt you to not eat it? Now, do you have a right to eat it? Yeah, Paul makes it clear. I can eat whatever I want. I have freedom in Jesus Christ. I can eat whatever I want. But does it help? Does it fix anything? Does it draw people closer together? Does it push them away? He reiterates that later on in chapter 10, verse 32. Give no offense either to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. Notice what he says there. Give no offense. Now, to the Jews, we understand that when it comes to things like circumcision and Sabbath keeping and food laws. To the Greeks, we understand that to be true as well. Don't give any offense to Greeks. But I think it's interesting how, in addition to don't offend the Jew, don't offend the Greek, what is the third category he includes there in that verse? And don't give offense to the church of God. Are there going to be situations where even between brothers and sisters in Christ, where we just have to be the one to compromise? Not on truly moral things, not on doctrinal issues. I think you understand what I mean by that. That in a year and a half of preaching at East Shelby, you should know by now that I don't really have to qualify that statement. But on these other matters of opinion, don't give offense to the Church of God. It's just easier. It's just more loving. Just do what you got to do to get along with each other. In Romans chapter 14, a very similar passage to this, he concludes his thoughts there, at least in that section in verse 19, where he says, "Pursue the things which make for peace and the building up of one another." And so Jesus in Matthew 17 is saying, I am exempt from paying the temple tax. I created everything. The gold, the timbers, the stones, the entire universe. I don't have to pay a tax. I don't have to pay a tax for a temple that was made for me. But we don't want to give them offense. Because giving them offense gives them a reason to ignore the message. Giving them offense gives them a reason to ignore the content and the substance of what we're trying to teach here. So, lest we give them offense, Peter, throw a hook into the sea. Cast a line. Pull up a fish, and the first fish that you pull out, open its mouth, and lo and behold, there's your temple tax. And it's enough to cover everybody. Just cover everybody. Very interesting way to end the story, isn't it? I know we read the story, it's like, what was that story about the fish with the coins in his mouth? I wonder, was this some kind of miraculous fish? Did Jesus put the coins in there miraculously, or is this just in some, you know, great providential sense that Jesus just happened to know in his vast knowledge, right? His omniscience. Did he just happen to know that there was some dumb fish in the sea that very stupidly chased after the shiniest thing that he could find, right? Everybody remembers Temitoa's song, right? From Moana, right? Fish are not very smart. Anything that shines, can you tell? I listen to a lot of Disney music in the car, my friends. I don't know. I don't know if this was just some like miraculously generated fish where Jesus in an instant just snapped his fingers and a fish just appeared out of nowhere. Or if Jesus just, again, in his complete omniscience, just knew by providence that there would happen to be the right fish at the right time in the right place with the right amount of money. Here's something I want to make before we bring our lesson to a close. I think we think of this as kind of a rather mundane little miracle of Jesus. How silly, though, to think of any miracle as mundane or little. Could you do this? I couldn't. Could I cast a line into a lake and just say, you know what? I owed a little to the IRS this year, and I'm just going to cast a line into the lake, and the first fish that comes up just so going to happen to have a cashier's check to cover exactly what I owed this year. I couldn't do that. I mean, I feel like every time I've cut a rainbow trout open and like, well, what's in its tummy? Let's see what it's been eating. I've had an undigested beetle in a bottle cap or something like that. Any miracle that Jesus performs, it's no mundane little miracle. This is the Son of God who is in complete control of his environment, who knows exactly what's going on all around him, who by either miracle or providence can look into the sea and say, there's a fish right there. It's got two coins in its mouth. And you're going to catch that fish right now. One writer put it really well in his commentary. Perhaps we too are reminded again of Jesus' humility. He who so controls nature and its power that he stills the storms and multiplies food now reminds Peter of the power, of that power by this miracle, while nevertheless remaining so humble that he would not needlessly cause offense. And may we always say the same as we interact with the people around us, to get along with our neighbors, to get along with our enemies, to get along with our brothers and sisters in Christ who should be the most valuable and most important people in the world to us. May we live like Jesus, who even in something as mundane and simple as paying a couple coins, was willing to give no offense and showed his sonship even in something like that. If you're not a Christian here this morning, you really ought to be. Listen to the message of Jesus himself, who says in Mark 16, verse 16, "He who believes and is baptized shall be saved, but he who does not believe shall be condemned." If you are tuning into our live stream, if you have any questions at all, if you have any spiritual needs, please reach out to the East Shelby Church of Christ. Let us know what we can do to help you. If you'd like to have a Bible study, we can meet via Zoom. We can have a phone call. We can meet in person. If it's someplace that you feel safe and comfortable, whatever you need, please don't delay another day. Don't delay 5 more minutes to let the Christians of this congregation know what your spiritual needs are. So whatever need that happens to be, please let it be known as we stand and sing together.